From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. When the historian Michael Quinn started digging into the economic history of the LDS Church, he didn't know what he would find, of course. What he expected, and what most of us imagine, is billions of dollars in assets and annual revenues. That he figured, because the business of Mormonism, Quinn says, has always been business. But what he didn't expect, and in fact what absolutely stunned him, was that most of that money was going to and being used for the benefit of the rank and file of the church and its ecclesiastical mission. Now, Quinn wishes they would be more transparent about their money, but he thinks the story of Mormon wealth and corporate power is mostly faith-promoting. Michael Quinn is joining us today to talk about the history of Mormons and money after the news.
Support for this Radio West podcast comes from Primary Children's Hospital. They're one of 24 children's hospitals in the country that's been recognized by U.S. News and World Reports for providing excellent care in all 10 pediatric specialties. Primary Children's Hospital, the child first and always.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. There's a saying used around here that you may have heard: the Mormon Church has more money than God, which is an irreverent, maybe cynical way of expressing what seems to be the vast wealth of the LDS Church, which most of us have to just guess at. The church does not publish or reveal its financial condition. It hasn't been transparent about its finances with the public or its own members for more than 50 years now. The historian Michael Quinn states the obvious when he calls Mormonism an American success story. But in his new book, he comes up with some numbers to illustrate just how successful we're talking. As you'll hear, it's billions, with a B, in annual revenue. Actually, tens of billions of dollars a year from tithing and the return on investments and real estate. But Quinn's book is also about the context behind that money, the history of this Mormon money, and the unique theology behind it. His book is called The Mormon Hierarchy, Wealth and Corporate Power, and he joined us earlier this week in the studio to talk about it. Michael Quinn is an independent historian whose work focuses on the LDS Church. We should also point out he was excommunicated from the church in 1993. He's speaking at Weller Bookworks this weekend. We'll give you some details about that as we go along. Michael, I want to begin with what the book is and what it isn't, because initially, I started thinking of it as this expose on the Mormon Empire. And then I realized, no, you're an historian. So it's an economic history on some level, but it also is an analysis of money. I mean, how much of it is kind of a journalistic expose on where you figure the church is money-wise versus more of the theological, historical underpinnings of Mormon corporate power?
Well, I think it's not an expose in my view, in the sense of the normal average understanding of expose. Expose typically has a polemical edge, and typically it's not a pleasant a mode of expression for whoever is being or whatever is being written about. And I have done my best throughout my writing career to avoid polemics. I've tried to be empathetic for every side of a debate or a controversy, and I have tried to present the evidence as I have found it, and I've tried not to tell my readers what to think, but I've tried to lay out context. And some people will see that context as allowing for a faith-promoting view, and other people will see that context as inviting them to have a negative view.
It's so interesting, though, to hear people who are critics of Mormonism disappointed by your assessment, which you've made a number of times, that you were kind of staggered by the faith-promoting potential for this story, that there wasn't lavish spending or corporate malfeasance, that it's a lot of money.
Yes.
But it seems to be going, as you've said, for the benefit of the church's ecclesiastical mission and the rank and file. What do you make of that, I guess, that disappointment from some that there's nothing more provocative here?
Well, I think that because the LDS Church stopped announcing it, even its summary of expenditures as of 1959, that has allowed a credibility gap to grow among not only critics of the church, but also members of the church who wonder, where is this tithing that I'm paying going? And there also is a misconception among those who know that there were reports from the early 1900s down to 1959 that those reports included all tithing received, and that's not the case. It was only in 1915 that the annual report listed all tithing received. After that, it was a list of and detailed list of expenditures in various categories, but no statement about income.
Exhaustive. You mentioned one conference, this may have been 1959, where someone sat and read a 15-page expenditure document.
Yeah, that was 1949.
49, yeah.
And that was, I think, the longest. And in the kind of book-like size of the printing of the conference minutes and conference talks, that report took 15 pages. And it's just mind-numbing to think of this audience of about 8,000 to 10,000 people, lots of children,
yep,
lots of teenagers, just listening to somebody drone on. But that was the degree to which church headquarters was committed at an earlier time to laying out the expenditures of the church so that the members of the church would know where their tithing was going.
But they don't anymore. They don't in any way do that. And I guess the question is, you're an historian, I'm not sure you can attach motivations to this, but it does make one wonder, are they worried about, you know, losing tax-exempt status if they're seen as, you know, somehow a profitable, quote-unquote, enterprise? Are they worried it may dampen the enthusiasm for members to pay tithing? I mean, why are they not transparent with members about that anymore?
Well, I think that the question of losing tax-exempt status would not apply because they have to report to the federal government in non-public format,
yeah,
all of the details of their finances. I know why the reports ended in 1959, and that was because the church had embarked on an extensive building program, purchasing land and building chapels and temples throughout the world in the late 1950s.
In the wake of World War II, I guess.
Yes, yeah. while much of Europe, much of Asia was still recovering from and rebuilding from war damage. And that essentially drained the entire, what was called a reserve fund, of unspent tithing that had been garnered over the previous 20 years. And the church was spending more money than they were receiving during that particular year, and they were making up the deficit with the saved funds that had been garnered over 20 years previously. And so to avoid those kind of acknowledgments, the reports ended.
But now they're flush. So why can't they come before the people and say, we're doing pretty well?
Yeah, well, that pretty well is tens of billions with a B of income from various sources annually, tens of billions in expenditures annually. And I think that because of the flush nature, as you said, of the church since the 1960s, that there has been a disincentive. It's a kind of the opposite side of the coin for why they ended the public reports. Now the church is doing and has been doing since the 1960s so well financially that I think that they're concerned that people might be hesitant about continuing to pay the tithing that they pay when there is so much coming in and has been coming in over decades to the church.
Okay, I just have to ask some basic numbers, and this may sound crass, but and then we'll get into some more particulars in a moment. How much does the church bring in per year, and what are their outlays? If you could just guesstimate.
In order to establish the quote, modern or 20th century income of the church, I need to take a step back.
Okay.
At one time, I had access to all the tithing figures annually, year by year, from the early 1900s down to 1962. And so based on the annual rate of growth of tithing from 1950 to 1959, I set up a projected annual increase from 1960 to 2010. And I regard that as conservative because during the 1950s, the church was paying for missionaries and missionary work, building buildings or renting space for church meetings. So applying that to 1960, 61, 62 on an annual basis, I came up with annual projections. And then I could test the early years of that projection because I had the figures of tithing for 1961 and 1962. And I compared them to my projections, and both of the projections were significantly lower than what the church actually received in 1961 and 1962. So I feel that although a straight line projection like that does not allow for changes such as a recession, overall I think that it is a conservative projection. The result of that projection was that in 2010, the tithing received by the church was $33 billion, with a B.
In 1 year.
In 1 year, in 2010. Now, on top of that is commercial income. And commercial income would be of two kinds. One, commercial income from for-profit businesses, and two, income from the portfolio of stocks and bonds managed by various entities. And the amounts of that have varied over time, but they varied on a very significant increasing basis. In the 1960s and 1970s, a counselor in the First Presidency, N. Eldon Tanner, was in charge of all the finances of the church. And he told the reporters for financial magazines in the United States and Canada in the late 1960s and in the late 1970s that the tithing received by the church was about 50% or more of what the church was receiving, and the rest came from commercial income. And so I understood that to mean that 40 to 45% in 1960s and 70s was coming from commercial income. And I do know from a variety of sources that the kind of approaches and both in terms of investment and risk management that N. Eldon Tanner established from the 1963 to his death in 1982 have been continued by the church's central financial officers to the present. So on top of the $33 billion of tithing received in 2010, I think you would have to say another $15 billion came from financial sources such as stocks, bonds, and for-profit businesses.
And how much are they spending a year, do you figure?
Now, that's a good question and unknowable for me. Yeah. What I do know is that during the period of conservative church expenditures from 1935 until 1952, the church was spending only 25 to 28% annually of its income. And the rest was going into church-owned banks, which, of course, even though they might provide a higher interest annually to the church as an investor, they were not providing what stocks and bonds could provide. Hmm. But the man who is in charge in the First Presidency detested the stock market. And so he would only allow the church's, what he called the reserve fund, to go in church-owned banks. N. Eldon Tanner changed that. the crisis that Enlold and Tanner faced by 1963 was so immense. It was a cash flow crisis. The church had multi times what it needed to pay in cash, in fixed income and fixed assets. But those were property, real estate, and business, and buildings that could not be immediately transferred to the cash needs. And so by 1963, when he had just been appointed as the manager of church finance for the entire church, the financial department didn't think it would be able to pay the payroll of its employees at church headquarters.
So how important
That's how severe it was.
How important is Enlold and Tanner to this story?
Enlold and Tanner is the most important, the single most important person to remember for the history of LDS finance from 1830 to the present. Because although he died in 1982, his policies for risk aversion and for investment have continued to govern the church to the present. And he transformed the church from staggering on the edge of an inability to pay its cash requirements for its own employees in 1963 to 1969, the church was completely, within 6 years, completely out of that kind of debt and was growing dramatically in its investment income. And that trajectory has continued to the present from all the indications I have, from what I have available to me in terms of the reports of church-owned or controlled businesses up to the present.
So I'm sensing some pushback on these tithing figures from some observers of Mormon finance. There's a blog critical of Mormon business called Mormonism 101, and it took issue with your $33 billion estimate, and I wanted to get you to respond to this. They said that using exponential growth to estimate annual tithing, that methodology is flawed. And they did this analysis based on activity rates and per capita income rates around the world. And they came up with a figure that was considerably less than that, $3.5 billion, upward of $4.5 billion is what they figured. And they said to get to your figure, you would need something like 9 million Mormons paying 100% tithing on their average income.
I'm glad you mentioned that analysis, because the author made several assumptions and several assertions that are simply untrue. One of them was he said that I could not have chosen a worse start date for my projection than 1960, because, as he said, in 1960, the growth rate of the Mormon Church, as we know, started to a terminal decline right around that time. Well, in 1960, the church was at a level double the rate of 1940. From 1960, the church doubled its membership in 14 years, not 20 years. That's an acceleration of growth, not a decline, and certainly not a terminal decline. And that wasn't just the only time. From 1974, the church doubled its population again by 1988. The other thing was that, as you pointed out, he claimed, or she, it could have been, I don't know
yeah,
who
I
it
don't
was,
either.
Said that the form of extrapolation or projection that I used was totally wrong, and I should have used a form that resulted in what the author of this said was a more reasonable amount, and that more reasonable amount, he stated, was that the income should have been an amount of millions, not billions, by 2010. And the chosen rate was essentially 1/100th of what I had proposed, and what he came up with was 352 million was the amount that what he argued was a more reasonable use of projections should be. But then, after having said that essentially 1% of what I argued was a more reasonable amount. Then by some smoke and mirrors method, he came up with an amount that was one-tenth of what I had proposed. At he said it would be between $2 and $4.5 billion. I do not claim to be a statistician. This person seems to, but on the basis of this analysis, I really question that. What I can say is that I was trained as a social historian in a program at the Newberry Library in Chicago with other social historians about using statistical methods on large data for analysis of the kinds of things we were interested in as social history. That is the extent of my training as a statistician. So I am open to being questioned or corrected by a statistician. I do not think that the author of this blog qualifies in that direction.
What do you think it comes from, that a critique like that? Is there some question about whether or not it's, in fact, tithing that's keeping the Mormon church alive versus its financial empire, I guess?
Well, I think there are two strains of skepticism. One is that on the part of critics, they think the church is a money-making activity for the general authorities, in particular the First Presidency and the Quorum of the Twelve, who manage this, what is, I don't think anyone questions, is a multi-billion dollar enterprise. And so because they have a prejudice, that is a judgment in that is independent of facts, that this is what the church leadership is about, when I point out that the 2014 internal document about the standardized living allowance given to all general authorities stated that their income as of that year was being increased to $120,000 a year from the church president down to the most recent appointee to a full-time 24/7 position. They disbelieve that. They say that was invented. And it's like, are you going to believe me or believe your lying eyes? And I tend to believe my lying eyes when I look at documents that have all the evidence of being authentic, real documents. The other thing is that if people, for whatever reason, doubt that the church is receiving tens of billions of dollars a year in annual income in the 21st century, they have to answer, I think, two essential questions about the international church and also about the internal United States investment. In the year 2006, LDS headquarters sent in cash nearly $500 million to the United Kingdom to supplement its tithing income to pay for its expenses. That's a industrial country. It's a country where the church has been in significant presence since 1837, and it is only one of more than 100 countries throughout the world, I don't know the exact number, that the church has significant numbers of members, has been building chapels, has been building temples, and is aiding the poor through its very well-known welfare program. And that kind of aid and those kinds of services occur throughout the world, including developing nations.
What you're saying is, essentially, there are very few places beyond Canada that are self-sustaining.
Right. In the developing world, the LDS Church headquarters in the United States has to pay, and I can demonstrate through annual reports in developing countries, that the church has been paying in the 20th century between 90 and 98% of the expenses each year of developing countries. And how I would ask people who doubt the church is receiving tens of billions of dollars a year, how could the church do this in all of the developing countries where it has members and its services and its functions if it isn't making tens of billions of dollars a year? The other internal within the United States is that the investment houses and the Salt Lake's principal investment house in the 21st century has been Ensign Peak Advisors. The president in 2003 did an interview with the church's Deseret News, and in that interview he said that within the company that he was a president of, he said billions of dollars exchange hands every day within this organization. And Ensign Peak Advisors is only one of the investment houses that handle the church's portfolio. So I think that the circumstantial as well as the tradition and the observable figures from an earlier time period would indicate that I am not far off, if I'm far off at all, in my suggestion that the church is bringing in tens of billions from all sources of U.S. dollars a year in total income.
It's the historian Michael Quinn. His new book is called The Mormon Hierarchy, Wealth and Corporate Power. On Saturday evening, he's going to be giving a talk and will be fielding questions at Weller Bookworks. That's in Trolley Square in Salt Lake City. You can get details about that on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the historian Michael Quinn about the economic history of the LDS Church. Quinn has been digging into this history for years now, and in his new book, he explores how the religion's unique theology never made a distinction between business and church. The book is called The Mormon Hierarchy, Wealth and Corporate Power. In financial terms, you say that Mormonism began with a personal loan.
Yes.
For a lot of money. It was a lot of money in relative terms. Let's go back there and tell that story.
So in 1830, Martin Harris, a devout follower of Joseph Smith, mortgaged his farm for $3,000 to pay for the publishing, the printing of the Book of Mormon. And that was necessary because the printer demanded everything paid in advance. And so Joseph Smith dictated a revelation in which the words of God said that do not be selfish with your own finances, Martin Harris. Give whatever is necessary for the publishing of my book, this Book of Mormon. And so Martin Harris not only mortgaged his farm, but against the will and wishes of his wife, mother of their three children. And not surprisingly to most women historically and in the present, their marriage ended very shortly after this happened. Now, that amount of money, that was equal to a loan in 2010 dollars of around $70,000. And that was a huge investment, and it ended up being a commercial loan because it was involved in a transaction that ended up with Martin Harris selling his farm totally. And
Harris
so,
is an interesting figure in this story because it's later that he comes to be troubled with the commercial enterprise that the church had become or was becoming.
That's true. And this is one of the characteristics of Mormonism that sets it apart from every other religious tradition that I know of. After Martin Harris sold his farm, just about the time that the sale was complete, in the end of summer and early fall, Joseph Smith dictated another revelation in which the words of the Lord said to him and to all of his followers that God had never given a temporal commandment to the children of men, that all the things that he had ever asked of them were spiritual. And
I just want to underline this,
because
this seems like the theological underpinning of Mormon ideas about money.
Right. And in fact, a Mormon apostle who was appointed in 1835, Orson Hyde, stated this in terms that I love, as a way of understanding the Mormon not only worldview, but cosmos view. In the 1860s, Orson Hyde, still an apostle, said, when it comes to dollars and cents, that's also spiritual to us.
So there's no distinction between the worldly, the secular, and the religious. In God's mind, in the Mormon cosmological view, they're intertwined. You can't separate them.
In the Mormon view, it's as spiritual, as religious, as devout to earn $100 as it is to give $100 to the poor. And it's a top-down thing. I mean, in all the other religious traditions, a Jew, a Muslim, a Christian, a Buddhist can say, I am entering into this business for profit, and I am dedicating it to the Lord. I am doing it unto the Lord. And that's a bottom-up kind of view of spirituality with reference to money-making. With God, it's top-down. God says, it's all spiritual to me. And so in the Doctrine and Covenants, Mormons themselves, who are critical of this lack of division between the spiritual and the temporal, between the money and the religious, need to look at those early revelations that Joseph Smith began giving in 1834 that are in the published Doctrine and Covenants of his revelation. In 1834, he gives a revelation about setting up a tannery, about operating a
hotel.
Store.
Yeah.
And Brigham Young gave Thus Saith the Lord revelations over the pulpit in the late 1860s, early 70s about building railroads. His successor, John Taylor, announced Thus Saith the Lord revelations about investing in mining companies. This is simply a part of Mormonism. It is the Mormon worldview. And when in the 1960s, when a counselor in the first presidency, this very liberal, politically liberal man, Hugh B. Brown, said to a general conference, we do not accept this division, this radical separation of the temporal and the spiritual. And then he referred to God as the CEO of the universe. And he used an American business term to describe God. That is from 1830 to the present, the Mormon worldview.
It's interesting the conflicted relationship between the LDS Church and seemingly— because on one hand, what you're saying is there is no distinction between the two. But then in 1875, Brigham Young and other high-ranking leaders of Mormonism signed this statement that condemned the excesses of capitalism, even though he was a brilliant capitalist.
That's true.
So I'm trying to figure that out.
Well, you have to look at it in the context. In 1875, that was the time in which there were very few millionaires in 1875 dollars within the United States. And those who were millionaires were routinely and almost universally called robber barons. They were men who had profited by paying the least amount of money possible to waves of immigrants. And there was no income tax. Brigham Young and his counselors and the Quorum of the 12 Apostles did not oppose making wealth. They did oppose the enormous accumulation of wealth in the hands of a very few. And they said it undermined the very foundations of the Republic of the United States of America to have this kind of huge gulf between the ultra-wealthy and the mass of people who were barely being able to put food on the table.
Seems rich, or more than a little ironic, for Brigham Young to be saying something like that when he himself was massively wealthy in relative terms to the time. And I want to read something because I think it's fascinating. This was in 1847 when the pioneers were headed west. And apparently some had been grumbling that Brigham Young and other high-ranking leaders of Mormonism were making more than the rank and file. And Brigham Young said, he asked this, he said, did Brigham Young ever get anything from you? Did you ever help him to any of his fine living, you poor curses? Or was it through Brigham's influence that thousands of the poor have been fed? He seems like to be saying, don't question me. I've got a lot of money. I deserve this amount of money. I've saved Mormonism or something. I don't know. It's really fascinating.
And about 20 years after that, he gave a public sermon where he said that because he had saved the church from its destruction after the death of Joseph Smith and had led the Mormons into the vastness of the West and had created this empire, so to speak, of protection and safety for the Mormon people, that he deserved a wealth that was equal to that of the church itself.
Yeah.
And he made it very clear. And he was a millionaire. He died with an initial appraisal of his assets of more than $1 million.
That's robber baron money of the
time. That is robber baron money. That's true. And his own wife wrote a couple of years before his death, and just shortly after the first presidency in 12 had made this condemnation of massive wealth in the hands of a few, she said, "I am embarrassed to be known as a wife," she was one of many,
yeah,
of Brigham Young, the richest man in the territory, because we have so little. And he was very tight-fisted with giving money not only to the apostles, but also to members of his own family, with one exception.
His son.
His favorite son. And he allowed this son to receive many times more financial compensation each year than anyone else received.
In today's dollars, you say it was $344,000 a year.
Yeah. And at a time when members of the Quorum of the Twelve were receiving a stipend that was, they had to ask for. There was no set stipend. And so they were, on average, receiving something on the order of 100 times less than his favored son. So, yeah, he and John W. Young, his son, were the glaring exceptions,
yeah,
to this general rule that the leaders of the church were generally of modest income and sometimes remarkably less wealthy than the rank and file of the church.
There's a kind of a remarkable equilibrium imposed by later leaders. It really impressive. David O. McKay, who was a president of the LDS Church, kind of finalized what you describe as this trend toward leveling out the salary that was going to be offered. And they were not, I think in relative terms, they were not making that much money. And David O. McKay, or a president of the church, was making as much, or in some cases less than, lower-ranking officials.
Right. At death, over a period from 1840 to 1988, I was able to look at the appraisals of the estates of most of the general authorities, not all, who died during those years. And then I equated all of those figures of appraisal to 2010 dollars, and then established, not in order of their hierarchy position, but in order of their wealth in 2010 dollars at death. What stunned me is I expected all of the presidents of the church to be at the top. And what I found was, for example, with David O. McKay, who died in 1970, that there were about 21 other lower-ranking general authorities who were worth more in 2010 equalized dollars than he was at death. And this stunned me. I had no expectation that there would be that kind of pattern, but I found it. And there were general authorities who were extremely wealthy. Generally, they were members of the first presidency. But these were avid businessmen who had been avid businessmen even before they became general authorities. And they just carried that entrepreneurship into their lives as leaders of the church. So in terms of the historical patterns of the church, make it very difficult for me to take seriously any doubters, any skeptics' complaint that the leaders of the church in the 21st century are in it for the money. When I was giving this as a book talk in San Francisco, one member of the audience raised his hand and said, "You know, Mike, The CEO of the Red Cross makes $1.2 million a year in salaries, not counting benefits. And then I had to compare that to the president of the church, who in the 21st century, in the last reported amount in 2014, was making a living allowance of $120,000.
So a Mormon general authority gets paid $120,000 a year, we think. They don't call it a salary, of course. And it's interesting you do write about the relationship or the history of the idea of this so-called lay ministry. One of the distinctive elements of Mormonism has been that lay ministry. Its ecclesiastical leaders, at least initially, are believed not to be paid at all. You say in the book that early Mormons had made, you know, demeaning comments about Christianity's paid ministry. How do they square that with the fact that, in fact, their ministers do get paid, at least the high-ranking leaders?
And that's an irony, and it has been a polemical argument or assertion, and I quote from church publications as early as 1836, denouncing salaried or paid priests.
Hireling priests. Yeah.
And that was a clarion call among Mormons throughout the 19th century. I found that church publications stopped those kinds of condemnations around 1900. But even down to the late 20th century, I could find criticisms in church publications down to the, say, 1970s, 80s, about what was called a paid ministry. Softer terms, not hireling priests, but still a
critical
condemnation.
Yeah.
The irony is that from the early 1830s, the highest leaders of the church were receiving financial support from the church. It was very often on an on-and-off basis. It was not there was a proposal for making a salary, and the church membership voted that down. At that time, a common consent didn't mean everyone universally raised their hand. It meant that people could dissent and still remain members of the church in good standing. Then from 1877 onward, there were set salaries. There hadn't been, since that initial vote in the early 1830s, any kind of set salary for the leadership of the church. But after Brigham Young's death, it was set up on a stratified basis. In other words, the president of the church received the most. His counselors received the next most on a monthly basis. Then the senior members of the 12 received the next most. And then from 1877 unto...
which is the death of Brigham
Young. Death of Brigham Young, when the salary system is established, until the 1890s, the poor Council of 70 didn't receive any salary, and neither did the patriarch to the church, who was also called the presiding patriarch.
I have to say, one of the questions that I did wonder about, a lot of general authorities, and it's certainly the case for the, if you look at the current hierarchy of Mormonism today, many extremely successful business CEOs and executives and you know, the highest claimed of their fields in many cases, you know, in law and medicine. So financially self-sufficient anyway. I'm wondering, do they receive the stipend? How much of this is in-kind contributions? And can they spend it on whatever they want? I mean, they're getting a car, I'm sure. They're getting housing, I'm sure. So is the salary beyond that? Do they pay tithing on it? Because you mentioned in the book, in the early days of the church, the 12 apostles voted themselves exempt from tithing. Do we know any of those things?
Yes. That exemption of tithing occurred only in Nauvoo in 1845 and applied only to 1845-47, as I am able to determine.
So wait, so the church gives... Let's take one of them, Dallin H. Oaks, $120,000 a year, and he pays tithing on that money back to the church?
That's right. In fact, I have the tithing records of the general authorities from 1912 to 1928. It can serve as a proxy for their income, that you can say, all right, this tithing is a 10% proxy for the income they made each of those years from 1912 to 1928. And then I compared that to the highest tithe payers among Mormons generally, who also reported that what they paid was a full tithing on their income. Hmm. And then I compared what that average of the highest 15 tithe payers in the church was each of those years to the reported tithing paid by the general authorities. And in most cases, the general authorities were paying far less than the most wealthy Mormons. And I know that from the probate records down to the 1970s, the general authorities were still paying tithing. And that included total income from the church allowance, as well as any stock and bond benefits they might receive. They paid tithing on that.
Well, that makes sense. That part makes sense. That makes sense if they're making money off of a book, a Deseret book that they've written, and then they're paying tithing. But it does seem odd that they're paying tithing to the allowance that they're getting from the church. But I guess this is a principle, and it does raise a question. When did tithing become such an important thing for Mormonism? Because it doesn't seem like it always was.
No, it was always considered a commandment from the Lord.
Sure.
But the definitions of tithing varied. In the early days of the Mormon church, tithing meant that you paid one-tenth of everything you owned upon your baptism into the LDS Church. That was reduced under Brigham Young to an annual tithing that was expected that you would pay on your increase, no matter what the source of that increase. In 1887, the Congress passed a law that disincorporated the LDS Church because of its opposition to federal authority and seized all of the assets of the church, both cash instruments and real estate, valued over $50,000 total. Well, this plus very bad business investments left the church saddled with about $2.5 million of debt when Lorenzo Snow became church president in September 1898. And 2 years later, he began, as a way of paying off this debt, a tremendous emphasis on every member of the church paying tithing. And in 1907, at the April conference, the president of the church, Joseph F. Smith, who succeeded Lorenzo Snow, said that because of this devout payment of tithing, the church was completely debt-free. And he made the statement, we can now pay everything as we go, and we don't owe a dollar to anyone. However, what I found was that the church, for different reasons, ended up almost on the edge of bankruptcy. And that happened repeatedly, and the last time was in the early 1960s when the church officers weren't sure they could even pay the church payroll. That's the last time that has ever happened for the church. And even though I'm sure the church's portfolio took a hit in the recession from 2007 to 2009, but during that time period, the church never said to the membership, oh, because of these severe times we're in, we are no longer going to pay for everything that we've been paying for up till now, the missionaries, the building maintenance, the building of temples and churches that we've been paying. We now have to ask you to do that. That did not happen. There was a tremendous reserve fund that allowed the church to ride out those financial downturns.
It's Michael Quinn. His new book is The Mormon Hierarchy, Wealth and Corporate Power. He's going to be speaking at Weller Bookworks in Salt Lake City on Saturday. You can get particulars about that on our website at radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with the historian Michael Quinn. We're talking about his new book, The Mormon Hierarchy, Wealth and Corporate Power. If you don't have leaders living lavish lifestyles, if the church isn't squandering money on projects that don't seem to bring a return, it raises the other question of proportionally – what are they spending on charity versus what they're spending on buildings? How much in that approaching $50 billion a year of revenue that they're receiving from tithing and from commercial investments, $46, $47, $48 billion, let's say. How much of that is being spent that you know of on buildings, temples, maintenance versus just sheer charity? Food shipments to Haiti or sub-Saharan Africa. Do you have any idea?
No, in the sense of the kinds of detail that the church was giving even up until 1959, its last public statement of finances. However, there was a report that the church headquarters gave that showed that in the early 20th century, during a previous 20-year period, the church had spent $1 billion, a little bit more, billion and change, I'll say.
And change.
And change on welfare. And then when that report came out and became known, people criticized, and I quote one of the criticisms that a 29-year-old Mormon made, that this is no comfort to know that the church paid less in a 20-year period for the charitable service than it paid for building the City Creek Mall, which was a $1.5 billion.
Yeah.
And I understand that criticism. However, it's based on an unfortunate distinction that was not made in that headquarters report. They were reporting cash payments of $1 billion plus during that 20-year period, and they were not counting the value of all the non-cash emergency aid, the food that was produced on church-owned welfare farms, the clothing that had been manufactured or donated, and the emergency medical supplies that were sent in all of these countries. My guess is if you were to count the value of all of this non-cash, it would equal perhaps 20 times what the church paid out in cash during that 20-year period. So the church does have enormous resources. What are the total assets of the church? The problem is that, as Gordon B. Hinckley, president of the church, often stated when he was talking at about church finances, the church has tremendous assets, but most of them are
fixed.
They're fixed assets. Yeah. They are land, and they are land and buildings, and the land is taxable until a building is on it. And then those that are not taxable, that do have tax exemptions, consume money for upkeep, for building, for maintenance of the building, for repairs of the buildings. All that comes out of the general funds of the church. The real question that people should be asking are, what are the net assets of the church beyond all the expenditures connected with those assets? And then that is a real number of wealth. But that was never even assessed and given to the public at any time. That kind of statement was never given.
One of the critical questions you expressed late in the book is that for a time, the church's, and here's how you put it, direct participation in corporate life took time away from strictly ecclesiastical responsibilities.
Right. And this is one of the ironies. Mormons have had this theological, not just a practical distinction, that they are unlike anyone else in that they do not make a distinction between the temporal and the spiritual. But the Mormons' leadership also made practical. I mean, Mormons are very pragmatic. And so even though theologically the Mormon leadership did not recognize a distinction between business activities and other kinds of activities they conducted for the benefit of the church, they acknowledged a pragmatic distinction that if you're attending to corporate meetings and concerned and watching the financial pages for the value of stocks on a daily basis. This is taking away from the time and energy that you otherwise have to give to strictly ecclesiastical things, things that involve wards and stakes and the daily life of members of the church. And so there were frequent, from the pioneer Utah days of Brigham Young, frequent public expressions as well as private expressions that I'm giving too much time to these corporations, and I want to give more time to the strictly ecclesiastical things that involve the flock, the rank and file. And so Brigham Young gave this explanation in the mid-60s while he was resigning from the boards or presidencies of church-owned corporations. And in the 1890s, the members of the Quorum of the Twelve were concerned that it was sapping the strength of the president of the church, who was quite elderly at that time. They wanted him to be relieved from as many of these business activities as possible. Finally, in the 1970s, a president of the church said, enough. And he, his name was Spencer W. Kimball, and in the mid-1970s, he said, I'm withdrawing from all of these corporate responsibilities that I have, and my counselors are too. In practical terms, though, they didn't totally withdraw. It took 20 years.
Yeah.
But in 1996, there was a public announcement that all the general authorities were going to withdraw from all of these corporate responsibilities, particularly in for-profit companies. However, there is a significant exception, and that is the presiding bishopric. The presiding bishop and his counselors, and that is consistent with the revelatory definition of her office. They are involved in what Mormons regard as temporal activities.
It almost seems quaint to think of N. Eldon Tanner helping to run the business affairs of the LDS Church in 2017. It seems like a quaint idea because, and you mentioned that high-ranking leaders may have once run the businesses, but now, and managed the investments, but not so much anymore, it seems. You mentioned there's a highly trusted network of what you call subordinate administrators. I guess the question is, who's running the business now? It's not the general authorities as much?
Well, there's an unseen presence that even though these for-profit businesses that are run by rank-and-file men who have an independent salary paid by these businesses, and they are not general authorities, they look to guidelines that the First Presidency has given them or that members of the 12 have given, all right, we would like your corporation to do this and this in a general sense. And they try to follow those general guidelines. And then if it becomes more specific than that, then they will. But these men, the three members of the Quorum of the First Presidency and the 12 members of the Quorum of the 12 in particular, are putting out fires internationally. They have a 16 million member church scattered throughout the industrial world and the developing nations of the world. And they have all of these temples, almost 200 temples. They have all of these congregations, thousands of congregations, large and small, that they're concerned about and that have administrative issues and then these personal issues of these 16 million members of the church. And they simply are running to keep up. Whether the stock market goes up and down is really of little consequence to the members of the highest leaders of the church when they have all those other responsibilities to look for. And so they delegate this to lower-ranking authorities of the church or to rank-and-file administrators who they have entrusted with being the CEOs of these businesses. The church simply cannot, as a leadership with these 15 men at the highest levels, be involved in the day-to-day operations of any of these businesses.
You are no longer a member of record of the LDS Church.
That's correct.
Has this in any way, I'm taken by terms you've used, staggered, stunned by, in a good way, the sort of the generosity of the church, the level playing field that they seem to have imposed, self-imposed upon themselves when they didn't have to, given the, as you said, you know, tens of billions of dollars here at stake. Has it in any way made you rethink your own personal relationship with Mormonism?
No, I am no longer member of the LDS Church on record. However, I'm a seventh generation Mormon, and nothing can take that away from me.
Right.
And I am a believing Mormon. I believe in the essentials of Mormonism. I believe that Joseph Smith and all of his successors to the present in the LDS Church, to Thomas S. Monson, have been given divine appointments by God to serve as prophets, seers, and revelators. I believe the Book of Mormon is the Word of God. I believe in gold plates. I believe in administration. I do not believe that every policy announced by the church is the Word of God or the will of God or needs to be forever. That's why Mormons believe in what is called continual revelation. Even though I do not attend church, I have a mystical relationship with God. I'm kind of like a Mormon medieval mystic, that it's like the medieval mystics of Europe. It's you and me, God. And the institutional church is important, but it is not my primary spiritual source of knowledge or of devotion.
So hearing that the church is attending to its stewardship of this money makes you feel better, but it doesn't make you want to go back to church necessarily.
No. There are certain policies that are late 20th century and now early 21st century policies that I cannot accept and will not return to the LDS Church or think of returning unless those are changed. But I believe that these men, even if they have enacted policies that I disagree with and think that are not the Lord's will, I still admire them and accept them as prophets, seers, and revelators, or as men who have those offices who are able to receive the will and will of the Lord if they seek for it. And in some cases, they may be guided by private or cultural prejudices that have determined some of the policies that were regarded as ironclad in the past and that I think are the source of some of the policies that are regarded as ironclad in the present.
Michael Quinn, he's the author of the book, The Mormon Hierarchy, Wealth, and Corporate Power. On Saturday night, he's going to be speaking at Weller Bookworks in Salt Lake City. You can get the details on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to Anthony Scoma. We had technical direction from Michael Havey. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.